So, I wonder if you know anybody who is wise. If you do, perhaps take a few moments to think about them, recollect them. What are they like? What is it about them that makes you think that they're wise? In what ways are they wise? Of course, it's unlikely that the person you're thinking about is wise in every single respect. Probably they're wise in some ways, or at some times, and at other times perhaps they're not quite so wise, or in other ways they're not quite so wise. But perhaps at their best, they're wise. So think of them as they are at their best. Perhaps you don't know anyone who's wise. Perhaps you think, well, I don't know anyone who's wise, actually. So you must then have some idea what a wise person is like. That is, nothing like anybody you know. So think about a person you know who is definitely not wise. And then think about what is it about them that isn't wise. And then think about someone completely different, an imaginary person. So, for instance, if they take offence very easily, if they're very touchy, if you make one slight criticism, they get really defensive and take offence, you might think, well, that's not a wise thing. So that means that a wise person is someone who doesn't take offence, someone who is able to receive criticism with equanimity. So, in that case, you'll have to think of an imaginary person. Most of us, I think, have some idea what a wise person is like. When I teach 6-week courses on Buddhism to beginners, in the fifth week is all about wisdom. And what I do is I get people to reflect for 5 minutes on the question that I've just asked you. Do you know anyone who's wise? Or if not, think of an imaginary wise person. And the results are amazing. I get them to stop and reflect for 5 minutes. Then I get them to go into small groups, and they all throw into that group what they think a wise person's like. And then we have a plenary session, and they all shout these wise, what a wise person is like, and I put it up on the flip chart. And we get a wonderful portrait of a wise person. People have a pretty good idea, I would say, of what a wise person would be like, were they to meet one, if they don't know one already. And in fact, in 1980, a couple of psychologists carried out a study on wise persons, and they asked a whole bunch of people what they thought the qualities would be, or are, of a wise person. And they found that these responses clustered into three areas. They were affective. This is a psychologist way of saying emotional. I don't know why they say affective, but they seem to prefer the word affective rather than emotional, but they seem to mean more or less the same thing. So affective, reflective, and cognitive. So the affective qualities, that's say the emotional qualities mentioned, were wise people are peaceful, empathetic, understanding, and gentle. And the reflective characteristics were introspective and intuitive. And the cognitive characteristics were pragmatic, observant, and intelligent. So now, let's go back to this wise person that I asked you to think about right at the beginning, either a real one or an imaginary one. What are the qualities that that person possesses? You could make your own list, I think. Once you've thought about this for a while, I'm not saying do this right now, because you're supposed to be listening to me as well, but sometime, later on maybe, or in the next few days, spend some time reflecting on these qualities. Don't just think about them, but try to feel your way into them. Try to understand what it might be like for oneself, for you, to possess those qualities. What might it like to be someone, for instance, who is peaceful, empathetic, understanding, gentle, introspective, intuitive, observant, and intelligent? Assuming you're not that already. Or if you are that, of course, you could be more of that. So, reflecting on the qualities of the wise was apparently taught and practiced in the ancient Greek and Roman philosophical schools. That's according to Pierre Hadot, who was a historian of ancient philosophy. He said, I'll quote him, "In the teaching of ancient philosophy, a major role was played by the discourse, which consisted in describing the sage, the wise one. It was less important to trace the features of concrete, particularly noteworthy philosophies." Oh, that's wrong, isn't it? Oh, that's right. "It was less important to trace the features of concrete, particular aspects than to define the sage's ideal behaviour and ask, what would the sage do in such and such circumstances?" So, why? Why reflect on these qualities? What would be the point? I think the point is that there is no such thing as wisdom in the abstract. There's not a thing called wisdom out there in the universe that we're trying to get hold of and imbibe. Wisdom is embodied in people. You only get wise people, wise beings. So by reflecting on those beings, we begin to understand a bit more what wisdom is. So, first thing is, by reflecting on the qualities of the wise, or the way wisdom is expressed in wise individuals, can encourage us and inspire us to emulate them. If other people can become wise, so can we. And also, by reflecting on the qualities of the wise, we tend to become a little bit wiser ourselves. So how does this work? Let's take the first of the qualities that I mentioned from that 1980 study, peacefulness. Wise people, these people thought, were wise, were peaceful. So what that means is, if those people were right, what that means is that when we become wise, we become peaceful. So wisdom brings peace. But I think it works the other way around too. That by developing peacefulness within ourselves, we tend to become wiser. And that seems to be true, doesn't it? That, you know, when you're quite agitated and stressed out and anxious and a bit all over the place, you can make quite unwise decisions, can't you? I can, anyway. That's when I make my most unwise decisions, when I'm a bit stressed, when I'm agitated. I'll make quite unwise decisions. But when we're feeling really calm and peaceful, we tend to make wiser decisions. Our mind inclines more to wisdom. And we can go a bit further than this, and we can say that a wise person will actually behave differently than an unwise person. For instance, if those people interviewed in 1980, if they were right, if wise people are understanding, gentle, then these qualities will be expressed in their behaviour. Here, understanding is not cognitive understanding, it's one of the affective, one of the emotional qualities. So what understanding means here, I suppose, is they're more empathetic towards others. They tend to understand people. Their understanding of people's weaknesses and foibles and so on, and their conditions. So, if a wise person is more understanding of other people, if we try to become a bit more tolerant of other people, a bit more empathetic towards them, a bit less judgmental about them, then it tends to make us wiser. I remember talking to someone, a doctor, who trains medical health professionals in communication. And what she does is she gets actors to come along, and the medical professional, it might be a doctor, it might be a consultant, it could be any, what they have to do, they have to tell this actor, and they know it's an actor, some very bad news. You know, oh, I just looked at these tests and I've got some very bad news for you. And they tell the actor the news, and then the actor tells them what it was like to receive the news. And they give them feedback, and they say, well, actually, you could have been a bit more understanding and empathetic when you said it. So then the doctor or the consultant has to have another go, and they have to act as if they were empathetic and understanding. And it was quite interesting. The result was the doctor or the consultant, when they were acting out being understanding and empathetic, they felt false. They felt that it wasn't really them. I suppose what was really them was someone who was not understanding of other people and so on, but they felt there's a certain sense of falsity about it. But then the trainer then said, well, would you like to hear what it's like from the actor's point of view? And the actor said, you know, that felt a lot better to me. It was much better the way you did it then. I felt really, it was much better to hear the bad news in that kind of context. So even though the health professional was kind of acting out being understanding and empathetic and so on, they weren't really being understanding and empathetic, by acting it out, it had a really good effect on the person they were communicating to. So there's a book I've been reading recently called The Compassionate Mind by Paul Gilbert, which is a really wonderful book. How many of you, anybody heard of Paul Gilbert? He's just great. He's a psychologist, clinical psychologist, been working in the NHS for 30 years with people with depression, and he discovered quite early on in his career that compassion was the way to help people with depression. And so in the way that Jon Kabat-Zinn has brought mindfulness into the health world, Paul Gilbert has done a very, very good job of bringing compassion explicitly into the NHS. So what he says, he offers a number of exercises to us in this book to help us develop kindness and compassion. And one of these is to get into the role, as he says, get into the role of a wise, compassionate person, as if you're an actor. And to do it successfully, he says, you have to get in touch with what it's really like to be a wise and compassionate person. So he says, imagine that you are a deeply compassionate and wise person. Think of the ideal qualities that you would like to have. These might include deep kindness, warmth, gentleness, being difficult to provoke. That's a good one, isn't it? A sense of having been there and gaining wisdom as a result. It doesn't matter if you actually have these qualities or not, because you're focusing on imagining and thinking about what it would be like to have them, what they are, and your desire to develop them. So this is a remarkable thing to do, isn't it? In a sense, well, I think some of you were here earlier when you visualised the Buddha. Did you have visualisation of the Buddha? This is a meditation practice, quite a popular meditation practice. You visualise the Buddha. So what is it you're actually doing when you visualise the Buddha? You're imagining the Buddha. You're imagining what it must be like to be the Buddha. But this idea, this exercise that Paul Gilbert suggests that we do, is taking it a step further, I think, outside of meditation, but acting as if you were now already wise and compassionate. Of course, there's a fine line here between pretending, this kind of pretentiousness. You know how, I don't know if you've ever met anybody who's trying to live a spiritual life, and there's a certain sense of unreality about them. Sometimes you can get that, can't you? They're just too mindful and calm to be true. You know, hello. Low voice, don't they? That's understanding voice. You almost feel like crying already. Hello. But after a while, you sort of think, So one has to be a bit careful of going down that road. But still, When you act as if you are already wise, what an interesting thing to do. And I would say, actually, that the practice of ethics is just that. An enlightened being is naturally ethical. They're not even, from their point of view, they're not being ethical. They're not trying to be ethical. They're just ethical. They just act like that. Let's say they're really understanding of other people and kind and gentle. Let's say they're kind and gentle. So when we're trying to practice ethics, we're trying to act as if we were kind and gentle. And sometimes, if you ever try to practice ethics, you know sometimes you really don't feel like being kind and gentle in a certain situation. But you try to do it anyway. And it kind of feels like it's going against the grain, doesn't it, sometimes? It's almost like you're trying to be kind and gentle through clenched teeth, sometimes. But by doing that, by just making yourself act as if you were kind and gentle, you kind of get into that mood. And after a while, you find that you are, in fact, being rather kind and gentle. And it becomes a bit easier. So, reflecting on the qualities of the wise, we've seen that this was a practice in ancient Greece and Rome. And in modern, the NHS, I suppose, Paul Gilbert's bringing these ideas into the NHS, into modern psychology. And you actually find it in the Buddhist tradition as well. Reflecting on the qualities of the wise is a Buddhist practice. And particularly we're recommended to reflect on the qualities of the wise, the Buddha. And this is called the practice of Buddhanusati. Buddha, Anusati. Sati is mindfulness, recollection. Anu means with. So Anusati means recollection or remembrance, calling to mind, keeping in mind, bearing in mind. So we're bearing in mind the Buddha. And the Buddhanusati practice is one of a set of three practices. There's also the Dhammanusati practice, which is reflecting on the qualities of the Dhamma, and the Sanghanusati practice, which is reflecting on the qualities of the Sangha. And these are called the three Anusatis, and you get them in the Tiratnavandana. The Tiratnavandana is verses which express the qualities first of the Buddha, then of the Dhamma, then of the Sangha. There's also a set of six Anusatis, and there's also a set of 10 Anusatis, but we haven't got time to go into all that right now. So I mentioned the Tiratnavandana. So here are the words of the Buddha Vandana, the qualities of the Buddha. Indeed, I'm not going to read Sangharakshita's translation, because many of you will know this already, and sometimes it's good to hear another translation. So here's Tanusaro's. Indeed, the Blessed One is worthy and rightly self-awakened, consummate in knowledge and conduct, well gone, knower of the cosmos, unexcelled trainer of those who can be tamed, teacher of devas and human beings, awakened, blessed. Very, very concise number of qualities of the Buddha. I know sometimes people find it a bit hard to relate to those particular verses of the Buddha, and I've come to the conclusion that before you can really appreciate those qualities of the Buddha, you really need to know quite a lot about Buddhism and about the Buddha. So I think it's good to read other texts that describe the Buddha. I think some of you have been listening to the Praises of the Buddha by Maitreya Chetta on today, but my favourite one is the Purabeda Sutta from the Suttanapatta, very ancient text. In the Purabeda Sutta, somebody who is nameless, we don't know who it is, asks the Buddha what a man of calm is like. So calm is, this is such an ancient text, it was even before the word Nibbana was used, or Bodhi. And the two words most commonly used in these texts, the ancient texts, for the goal of Buddhism, were calm, or tranquility, and purity. That was the goal of Buddhism, calmness and purity. So when this man asked the Buddha what a man of calm is like, what he's really asking is, what is a wise person really like? Now, it's a man of calm, so some of you may be feeling a bit excluded from this. I think it's true to say that the ancient Buddhist texts usually talk in terms of he. It's probably a convention that they use. So we could say a woman of calm as well. What is a woman of calm like? So the Buddha replies with a whole list of characteristics, what a man or a woman of calm is really like. Really quite wonderful. Because it's a very ancient text, it's sometimes a little bit cryptic. You don't quite know, because it's in very, very ancient Pali. Sometimes it's not completely clear what the Buddha is saying, and different translations say quite different things, and so it's obvious that the translators are interpreting. It's quite a lot of interpretation. But I'm just going to read you some of these verses from Saddhatissa's translation, because Saddhatissa is a good Buddhist monk, and he's tied it all up, and he's made it very Buddhist and very understandable. So, although the translation isn't completely accurate, probably, it still gives a very, very good impression. So now, it's all in terms of he. So sometimes I'm going to say he, and sometimes I'm going to say she. And sometimes I'll say they, to be really, really inclusive. She has no anger, and no fear, and no pride. So you have to imagine what it's like to be someone like this. Because this is interesting here, because the Buddha's telling someone what a man of calm is like. He's basically describing himself here. Yeah, this is a self-portrait, because the Buddha is a man of calm. No anger, no fear, and no pride. Nothing disturbs his composure, and nothing gives him cause for regret. Nothing gives him cause for regret. So there's no unethical behaviour. He is the wise man who is restrained in speech. Restraint is a very, very common quality in some of these texts. It's not a very popular quality these days, restraint. These days it's more let everything hang out, and if you're angry, just be angry. But restraint is a very, very highly valued quality in Buddhist texts. She does not conceal anything, and there is nothing she holds on to. Nothing she holds on to. Without acquisitiveness or envy, she remains unobtrusive. Unobtrusive. Again, perhaps not a very popular value these days, but unobtrusive. Staying in the background, perhaps. Not trying to push oneself forward and be something. Unobtrusive. He has no disdain or insult for anyone. He is not a man who is full of himself, or a man who is addicted to pleasure. She is a woman who is gentle and alert, with no blind faith. She shows no aversion to anything. No aversion to anything. He is not a person who works because he wants something. If he gets nothing at all, he remains unperturbed. I think this probably relates to monks and nuns who they're practicing the spiritual life just to practice the spiritual life. They don't mind if they get anything. They go around begging for food. They don't mind if they get anything or not. There is no craving to build up the passion to taste new pleasures. His mindfulness holds him poised in a constant even-mindedness or equanimity, where arrogance is impossible. She makes no comparisons with the rest of the world as superior, inferior, or equal. Because he understands the way things are, he is free from dependency, and there is nothing he relies on. Can you imagine being completely free from dependency, relying on absolutely nothing? For him, there is no more craving to exist or not to exist. That is what I call a man who is calmed, or a woman who is calmed. And he goes on at some length, actually. Very, very beautiful qualities. So this is what the Buddha said a wise person was like. One of the interesting things about it is hardly anywhere in there is wisdom as a cognitive thing mentioned. It's just once he or she understands the way things are. I think that's possibly the only reference to understanding in the intellectual, in the cognitive sense. The rest of the text is all about how they feel. He has no anger. Yeah. Or what they do. Does not seek after pleasure. So the text is all about how they feel, what their internal sense is like, and how they behave. It was Damien Keown, who, in his book, The Nature of Buddhist Ethics, who said that when you look at descriptions of the Buddha, there are basically two main sets of characteristics. One is their wisdom, and the other is their ethical behaviour, how they actually behave. So this is quite a wonderful practice, actually, to take a text like that, or the one some of you have been listening to today, Maitri Chetta's Qualities of the Buddha, and reflect on them. Really reflect on them. For instance, let's reflect for a short while on the line, he or she makes no comparison with the rest of the world as superior, inferior, or equal. This is a bit of a preoccupation of the Sutta Nipata, this idea of superior, inferior, or equal. Most of us can compare ourselves with others, don't we? We're doing that a lot of the time, you know. Oh, he's a bit older than I am, and she's greyer than I am. And he's a bit better looking than I am, I must admit. And he's a bit less intelligent, though, so it's okay. And we're just comparing them all the time. And we don't realise that we're doing this. It's a reflex. It's one of the things that our mind does, kind of naturally. But a wise person simply doesn't do it. They don't even think of themselves as equal with others. Yeah. They don't think of themselves as superior, sure. Nor do they think of themselves as inferior to others. They don't even think of themselves as equal, we're all equal. They don't even think in those terms. So what must it be like to be like that? To not even think in those terms. To not compare oneself at all with anyone else. The freedom we must experience. How wonderful. Well, on the topic of comparing, one thing to be aware of when reflecting on the qualities of the wise is the tendency to compare ourselves unfavourably with wise people. This is how it might go. You might be thinking of a wise person, you know, reflecting on their qualities. Oh, he is so wise, so great. He's kind and always has a good word for everyone. He never snaps at people. Fantastic. Not like me. Irritable, bad-tempered a lot of the time. Only yesterday I was grumpy with everyone. How do I expect to become wise like that person? I'll never manage it. It's just never happened in this life. Do you recognise that train of thought? And before you know it, you're beating yourself up. So the reflection on the quality of the wise has become yet another stick to beat yourself with. So we need to be really careful of that. So years ago, in a Mahayana text called the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, not yet, the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, the layman, the Bodhisattva Vimalakirti, sings the praises of Bodhisattvas. A great long thing, it goes on for pages. And one verse goes like this, and it's interesting that I picked up on this verse, and I always go back to it, and I've talked about it in many, many talks. So you learn a bit about me from this. Though they, the Bodhisattvas, though they worship Buddhas by the millions, with every conceivable offering, they never dwell upon the least difference between the Buddhas and themselves. Yeah? Never dwell on the least difference between the Buddhas and themselves. This is really interesting. So looking up to is not the same as comparing oneself with. You can look up to without comparing oneself unfavourably with that person. In fact, when we reflect on the qualities of the wise, we don't actually need even to think about ourselves at all. Yeah? Don't need to. It might be that you're reflecting on the qualities of a wise person, let's say they're really understanding it. You're really understanding yourself. You've already got that quality. Doesn't matter. You can still reflect on it. Because qualities are infinitely developable, if that's a word. You can develop them infinitely, more and more and more. So even if you are really gentle already, you could become even more gentle. So it really doesn't matter. Just take a quality and reflect on it and become that quality. So, this is all in terms of reflecting on the qualities of the wise, the qualities of the Buddha or Buddhas. But there's another way of doing this. So far I've been talking very much in terms of thinking, in analysing qualities. There's a lot of thought involved in what I've been talking about so far, but there's another way of doing it. A way that I call contemplation. In my own mind, I have a distinction between reflection and contemplation. Reflection, you're thinking about something. Contemplation, you're not. You're not thinking anymore. You've moved on. So in reflection, we don't have many thoughts. We don't have lots of words in our heads. We don't talk to ourselves. We don't follow a line of argument. It's more meditative. More silent, more still, more serene. So contemplation. In the dictionary, to contemplate is, this is a very old dictionary, but I think it still goes, the 1965 Oxford Universal Dictionary, which I still use. To contemplate is to look at with continued attention. Continued attention. Anusati. To gaze upon, to observe. And it comes from the Latin contemplare, or contemple. It's interesting that, isn't it? Which is, the dictionary tells me, an open place for observation, marked out by the augur. An augur is a soothsayer, a diviner, or a prophet. So an open place for observation marked out by the augur. I really, really like that. I like the idea of this open space. When we contemplate, we metaphorically open up a space in our consciousness, free from words and thoughts, and we try to dwell in that space so that we can simply gaze upon, observe, free from inner commentary. So to practice buddhanusati as a contemplation, we look at with continued attention each of the Buddha's qualities, but without thinking about them. The way it works best is you do a lot of thinking at first. You reflect on them first. That's the first thing you do. You reflect on them. You think about them, you wonder what it's like to have them. Is it possible to have them? You might even have doubts about that. Is it really possible to have all these qualities? You might discuss them with others. You do all that. You do all your thinking beforehand. And then you just hold a quality in your mind and keep it there. It's a bit like when you've been with a really good friend for a few hours, and you've talked and talked and talked, you've caught up with all the news, you've helped each other think things through, you've had a thoroughly great time for hours and hours. And it comes to evening time. It's a nice sunny evening, and you're in the back garden, and you've got a couple of drinks, and you just sit there, and your conversation dies away. And you're sitting there in companionable silence with your friend. There's no need to speak. Just being with that person wordlessly is enough. So this is like the difference between contemplation and reflection. So we take a quality. A wise person makes no comparison with themselves as with the rest of the world as superior, inferior, or equal. Now you don't have to rehearse the arguments through anymore. You don't have to think about it anymore. You've done your thinking. So now you just hold that quality in your mind. That's all. You just keep it there. It's like ringing a bell. You know, we haven't got one around here. No. You know when, just ding the gong. Just hold that quality like the ringing of the bell. So after a while, once you've done this over a period of time, first of all reflecting on the qualities, then contemplating the qualities, then after a while, you can just say the name Buddha. The Buddha holds all these qualities for you. Yeah? So when you just say the name Buddha, you don't have to think, oh yeah, what are those qualities? No fear, no anger, what's the other one? You've got them all. You've reflected on them. You've contemplated them. So when you say the name Buddha, the Buddha holds it all, just in that short, two-syllable word, Buddha. It's a bit like when you're first introduced to someone, Kalyanavacha. When I was first introduced to Kalyanavacha, that was just a name, something I didn't really know. But then, over the years, I've got to know Kalyanavacha better and better. So when everybody says Kalyanavacha, it's not just a label that affixes to somebody. The word Kalyanavacha holds everything that I know and feel about Kalyanavacha, just in that one word. So then, you can just sit there in meditation and you can just bring the name of the Buddha to mind. Buddha. And that's enough. That's all you have to do. Or you could do it visually. You could visualize, you could see the Buddha in your mind's eye. That's all. Because you know that the Buddha's got all these qualities that you've been reflecting on for the past few months. All there in that picture. And choose a picture that you really like. It could be a very simple one of the Buddha as a human being, you know, with a robe or rags, sitting out in the forest somewhere, usually meditating. That's how we usually see pictures of the Buddha. Or it could be a kind of an archetypal, symbolic Buddha, gold or red or blue or green, with light just shining out. It doesn't really matter. The main thing is to visualize them, just see them, and allow the qualities to shine through their form. And when we're doing that, when we're bringing the word Buddha to mind, when we're seeing the Buddha in our imagination, we're imagining. We're imagining the Buddha. Some of you know that I've been really very interested in Pure Land Buddhism. And in Pure Land Buddhism is a Mahayana school. And in Mahayana Buddhism, you get this idea of not just one Buddha, but many Buddhas. And if you notice that from the Vimalakirti text, it was millions of Buddhas. So in the Mahayana, you don't just get Buddha, the Buddha. You get millions of Buddhas in all directions of space, everywhere. So there are Buddhas just everywhere. So Buddhanusati in these texts means something really quite amazing. You're imagining Buddhahood everywhere in the whole universe. In the Avatamsaka Sutra, I think it is, or some school of Buddhism, I can't remember which one it is right now, but in some school of Buddhism you get this idea that Virochana Buddha is the universe. And this world system of ours, this galaxy of ours, is just contained in a pore of his skin. So here we are, we're in the Buddha now. This is the Buddha that we're in. We're in the pore of the Buddha's skin. Fantastic. So going back to the Pure Land Sutras, there's one. So you get this idea of Buddhanusati, which is the Buddha, but then you get the idea of Dharmanusati, which is the qualities of the Buddha, and that's expressed in the Buddha's pure land, in his universe. And then Sanghanusati, you reflect on the beings in that land. The beings in the pure land are the ideal Sangha. So, the Buddha is speaking to Shariputra. He says, "Furthermore, Shariputra, when the rows of palm trees and nets of tinkling bells in that Buddha field sway in the wind, a sweet and enrapturing sound issues from them. This concert of sounds is, Shariputra, like a set of heavenly cymbals, with 100,000 million playing parts. When these cymbals are played by expert musicians, a sweet and enrapturing sound issues from them. In exactly the same way, a sweet and enrapturing sound proceeds from these rows of palm trees and those nets of tinkling bells when they sway in the wind. When human beings in that world hear this sound, they remember the Buddha and feel his presence in their whole body. They remember the Dhamma and feel its presence in their whole body. They remember the Sangha and feel its presence in their whole body." So these are the three anusatis. Buddhanusati, reflecting on the ideal Buddha. Dharmanusati, reflecting on his land, which is an expression, his Dharma. And Sanghanusati, reflecting on the beings in that land who represent the ideal Sangha. And one of the interesting things about this quote, I don't know if you picked it up, was we should try to feel the presence of the Buddha in our whole body when we reflect on him. Feel the presence of the Buddha in our whole body. Now this probably chimes in very nicely with a current fashion in Western Buddhist circles, which is where the body is all important, where you meditate in the body and you touch enlightenment with the body. So it might refer to that kind of idea, but I think it also, body here, might also mean our whole being, including our body, but also mind and heart. Ideally, contemplation includes the whole of our being, all of our senses. And the sutras, the texts that describe Sukhavati, the Pure Land, invite the reader to imagine the Buddha, the land, and the beings in that land, not just to visualize them, not just a visualization exercise, but also to hear them and smell them and feel them. Feel that you're actually in the presence of the Pure Land. To contemplate is to imagine. And we only really imagine when the whole of us is present. Is that the H. Lawrence poem, isn't there, that's very popular? You've probably heard order members quote it in a talk. Thought, I love thought. And the final line is, "Thought is a man in his wholeness, wholly attending." D.H. Lawrence is a bit like Pali texts. Let's put it another way. "Thought is a woman in her wholeness, wholly attending." That's really interesting, because he could have said, "Thought is a man in his wholly attending." But it's a man in his wholeness, wholly attending. So it's a real emphasis on wholeness there. And I have to say that sometimes when I'm doing a meditation practice, when I'm visualizing the Buddha, for instance, trying to contemplate the Buddha, I'm not completely present when I'm doing it. If I'm doing it in the morning and I've got a busy day ahead, I might be anticipating my busy day. And I might be doing a bit of planning, as well as contemplating the Buddha, or worrying, as well as contemplating the Buddha. Or I might, there might be something on my mind, something's been going a bit wrong in my relationships with people, and then I'm contemplating the Buddha, and I'm sort of trying to figure out what's going on with my relationships at the same time. So basically I'm multitasking, which is what we all have learned to do, isn't it, in modern society. We multitask. So a lot of the time I'm multitasking when I'm trying to imagine the Buddha. But every now and then, something happens. And this something that happens seems to be outside of my conscious control. I can't make it happen, unfortunately. It either happens or it doesn't. But every now and then, I'm doing something like reflecting on the Buddha's qualities, and suddenly, vroom, I'm there. I am fully present. Yeah? The whole of my being, my body, no stray thoughts, not thinking about anything else. I am there. It's as if I slip in to what I'm doing. If I slip into the contemplation. It's a little bit like I might be driving in a car in the countryside and I'm looking out through the windows at the countryside and I can see it and it all looks very, very nice. And then I decide to stop the car and I get out and then I'm walking in the countryside. And you know, it's a very different experience, isn't it? When you're in the car, you're looking at the countryside from the outside. But when you get out of the car, you're actually in the countryside. You can feel it underneath your feet. You might even take your shoes off and feel the countryside. And then the earth. And then you can smell the smells. You know, maybe it's spring and you can smell flowers. Or maybe you're near the sea and you can smell the smell of the sea. And you can feel the breeze and the warmth of the sun on your face. And you're actually inside what you're looking at. You're in the midst of. The German philosopher Heidegger said that the word interest comes from interesse, which means to be in the midst of. It's an interesting idea that you're in the midst of it. And this is what I experience sometimes when I'm meditating. At first, it's almost like I'm estranged from the very thing I'm trying to do. I'm not in there. I'm not a part of it. I'm trying to get there, but it's away from me. But every now and then, it's as if suddenly, whoop, I'm there. I'm in the midst of it. It's all around me. So this is contemplation, and this is imagination. Of course, I'm using the word imagination in a very exalted sense here. I mean, we can imagine all sorts of things. We can imagine simply walking down the road and entering the room. And we can imagine talking to someone. We can imagine having sex with someone. We can imagine the world being a fabulous place. We can imagine all the people living for today. Imagination here, imagination, what I'm talking about, is a different thing. It's what Sangrach calls the imaginal faculty, where the whole of your being is involved. There's a beautiful description of this kind of state of mind in the novel Brick Lane by Monica Arlene. The heroine of the story, Nazneen, how many people have read Brick Lane? Yes. It's only down the road, isn't it? Brick Lane. One day, she's sitting on the floor of her living room, watching ice skating on the TV in the afternoon. Do you remember that section? And I quote, "While she sat, she was no longer a collection of the hopes, random thoughts, petty anxieties, and selfish wants that made her, but was whole and pure. The old Nazneen was sublimated, and the new Nazneen was filled with white light, glory." Isn't that fabulous? So good. While she sat, she was no longer a collection of the hopes, random thoughts, petty anxieties, and selfish wants that made her. Aren't we a bit like that ourselves, made up of all these things? But she was whole and pure. The old Nazneen was sublimated, and the new Nazneen was filled with white light, glory. So this is the imagination. How are we doing for time? It's 5:25. I expect you're getting to the point where you're thinking, this is good, but... finish soon. So let me move on quickly. There's a beautiful passage at the end of the Sutta Nipata, one of the earliest texts of the Pali Canon. I meant the Puravedha Suttas from the Sutta Nipata. You're getting the idea. There are basically three texts I really love: Pure Land, Vimalakirti Nirdesha, and the Sutta Nipata, the three ratna, the three jewels. So Pingya, an old man, Pingya, seems to describe this experience. He says, he's talking to his former teacher, who's a Brahmin, and he's describing his experience. And he says, I see him with my mind, as if with my eye. Being vigilant day and night, Brahmin, I pass the night revering him. For that very reason, I think there is no staying away from him. My faith and rapture, mind and mindfulness, do not stay away from the teaching of Gotama, the Buddha. In whatever direction the one of great wisdom goes, in that very direction I bow down. I am old and of feeble strength. For that very reason, my body does not go there. I go constantly on a mental journey, for my mind, Brahmin, is joined to him. That's wonderful, isn't it? Skipping a few bits here. Okay, so let's returning to the practice of Bhutanam Sati. Tradition tells us of a number of positive qualities coming from Bhutanam Sati. Now wait a minute, before I go on to that, I'll just retrace my steps if I can. Are you okay for a few minutes?
Yes.
Where is it? Ah, yes, here we are. That study I mentioned earlier, the 1980 study by the two psychologists asking people what they think the qualities of wise people are. In that same study, these two psychologists, they state that wisdom is a unique state, characterized by self-transcendence, which they define as being the capacity to, quote, move beyond individualistic concerns to more collective or universal issues. So this seems to me a rather technical and abstract way of saying that wise people care as much about the world around them and the beings that inhabit that world as they do about themselves. That's what that really means, I think. Self-transcendence really means this. Even more simply, it means that wise people are unselfish. Even more simply, it means that they love. Yeah. Wisdom is love. And I would say that Buddhism, the Buddhist tradition, agrees with this. That the goal of Buddhism is a state of unselfishness. You realise that this self that we've been carrying about, the burden. I read a book recently by a psychologist called The Curse of the Self. This curse, this burden that we carry around with us. And this is why we keep on comparing ourselves. This is the burden of selfhood, isn't it? When you're wise, you let go of that burden. And it's not that a wise person is unselfish despite the fact that they really like to get that thing that everyone else is after. A wise person doesn't even think about that because the self has slipped away from their consciousness, not even aware of their being a self. So, tradition tells us of a number of positive results coming about from practicing Bhutanam Sati. For instance, Buddha Ghosha, that great scholar, Buddha Ghosha, He says that anyone who regularly practices Buddhanusati attains the fullness of faith, mindfulness, understanding and merit. He conquers fear and dread. He comes to feel as if he were living in the master's presence. This is all he again, isn't it, you notice? Let's go back and say she. She attains the fullness of faith, mindfulness, understanding and merit. She conquers fear and dread. She comes to feel as if she were living in the master's presence. Let's say the Buddha's presence. Her mind tends towards the plane of the Buddha's. So this is the way Buddha Ghosha talks about the results of practicing the Buddhanusati. But years ago I came across another wonderful text, the great meditation master, 6th century Chinese scholar and meditation master, Zhe Yi, talked about the results, the qualities that come from practicing Buddhanusati. He says, in the state of dhyana, when our minds and bodies are quiet and tranquil, then all of a sudden there comes into the memory a recollection of the inconceivable merits and purity of all the Buddhas. As soon as we're dwelling in such remembrances of the Buddha's transcending attainments and merits, we feel springing up in our dhyana minds the development of a spirit of respect for all sentient life, and a feeling of fraternity with them. We feel unfolding powers of absorption, and a sense of joy and bliss pervades both body and mind that wraps us in a feeling of righteousness and safety. At such times, we are never disturbed by the appearance of any bad developments nor evil manifestations. When we retire from our jhana practice, our meditation practice, our body seems light and active, and we feel so confident in the possession of good qualities that we expect everyone whom we meet will respect us and respond to our goodwill. So what really struck me really strongly when I first came across this description was he doesn't really talk about the obvious thing, that when you reflect on the Buddha, when you visualize, you contemplate the Buddha, of course you'll gain more faith in the Buddha. And the way we talk about you're going for refuge to the Buddha will deepen. You'll go for refuge more deeply to the Buddha. It doesn't mention that at all. The thing that really surprised me was when we practice Buddhanusati, we feel springing up a spirit of respect for all sentient life and a feeling of fraternity with them, a feeling of love for all sentient life by reflecting on the Buddha. That's really interesting, isn't it? So, wisdom has a unique quality, which is self-transcendence, which is unselfishness, which is love. To be wise is to love. And if we don't love, that means there's something we haven't yet understood. We haven't yet perceived the world as it really is. When we reflect on anything at all, when we reflect on the Buddha's qualities, when we contemplate the Buddha's qualities, we're becoming wiser. But we could just as easily say we're learning to love better. Reflection is an act of love. So that's it.